for us.
So, no. It's true.
Gary Kitchen, I worked on the East Coast while these guys were all on the West Coast. I started the East Coast design office for Activision and did a few titles on the 2600 and the Commodore.
Who's whistling? Al Miller. I did several games at Activision, and a few more before that at Atari. What do you guys want to talk about? We're totally like open forum here, and in fact, it's frequently better if we get interaction with the audience.
Actually, I have a good question. How many people have been here in the past and heard us talk about Activision? What percentage? Because we can get an idea of whether or not we repeat the old stories again.
Of course, you repeat the old stories. Well, what are you thinking?
Because actually, we met for lunch about an hour ago, and with the purpose of coming up with a list of topics, and it occurred to me that, you know, this was 20 years ago. I don't remember anything that happened back then.
All right, so Dave, you have a list. Why don't we go down the list of possible topics, and all you guys can jump in and ask questions.
Well, I think that all you guys there just totally innovated kind of like game design on the 2600 system. It's amazing what you guys can do. Can you tell us a little bit about how you were able to bring out some of the potential in that system, the potential that I guess people at Atari couldn't get at?
It's a great question. Dave?
All right.
We got to go right to the innovator.
Well, where to start? The most important thing to understand about the 2600 is how it got engineered and why it allowed for so much innovation. That's not me. I know it's not me. Basically, back in those days, the cost of integrated circuits was very high. You know, they can put millions and millions of transistors on a chip these days for very little money. But back then, if you could save a thousandth of an inch off of the chip size, you would save a lot of money, and there were your profits for selling consumer electronics. So when the Atari 2600 was being developed, they had a microprocessor in it, of course, and then it also had a video display chip. That video display chip was nothing like what we have today, and you know, the graphics are very rudimentary. But that didn't stop us from doing high-speed, you know, good interactive games. But the when the chip was in its development, they had a problem, and it was just plain old too big. They couldn't make it do everything they wanted it to do in the size of chip that was really allotted to them. Basically, as you got larger, the cost got exponentially greater. That was the biggest problem. You could make a bigger chip, but the prices just went through the roof. So the engineers were instructed to reduce the size of the chip before the manufacture of the video game. So they came up with the idea, all right, well, we're going to make this game program, or this game system, cartridge programmable. So let's figure out what things that the software can do that would let us take things out of the hardware. So instead of putting everything into the box itself, all the capability of sprites and colors and backgrounds and sounds and all these things, they figured out ways to have the microprocessor manipulate simpler hardware and do the same things, putting a lot of the onus on the program. All right, so you got all these huge sections of program in 2600 that were doing nothing but functions that were supposedly should have been done by the hardware under any other circumstance, but they couldn't afford it. Well, the luck of that was, when you sell the 2600, you can't change it. That's the thing that's in grandma's house, you know, sitting there next to your television. And it's the cartridge that gets removed and changed every time you sell a new video game. So through just sheer luck, by making the software do so much more of the function of the video game, they made the system much more versatile. And it looks like it's brilliance, but it was really luck back then. So since the software was doing so much of it, and the software was the part that was removed, every time you put in a new game, you have complete control of the manipulation of the hardware that was in there, instead of being limited to what the engineers thought of when they designed the chip. And in the early days at Atari, we had the chip designer, you know, walk up to our screens while we were working and just shake his head, and he said, I never had any idea that this machine could do that. And he's the guy who designed it. So by leaving that kind of flexibility into the software, it gave us all sorts of capability for doing unique things. And we approached it from engineering backgrounds rather than computer science backgrounds. With a computer science background, you would tend to say, what is the instruction that I can use? And therefore, you use it. When we say, well, what is the hardware doing and how do I manipulate it and make it do something else? So just by enjoying the puzzle of creating, of making it do something that the designers didn't intend, we ended up making all these different capabilities, adding to the capabilities of the system. And from there, we'd say, all right, well, gee, now that I know it can do this, I mean, if it can do, you know, my fishing line, for example, that was a trick. I came up with a way to make this thing look like a fishing line. Well, I mean, I kind of had to make a fishing game when that happened. With each game, we did that. How can we push the limits, the boundaries of the capability, and then with those new tools, what do we do to make a fun game?
I think there's another dynamic, which is less technical than what Dave was talking about, was you get a bunch of bright guys together in a company and someone does something really good, well, it raises the bar. And then all the other designers see it and say, well, I have to achieve that level. And then they do something good and the next guy says, well, I've got to beat that. So I think that, I mean, Activision was founded with the idea that there was a very high standard of what was worth shipping. I mean, there were products we worked on that never shipped. I mean, you notice Matt said he did two games that shipped. Well, there were titles that never shipped. There were titles that we all worked on that in various stages we put aside because there was such a high internal standard that if it didn't blow your doors off when you saw it, well, then it didn't go out. And the company was so successful that there wasn't the financial pressure there is sometimes in the game industry to say, just put it out. We've got to recoup our money. So what if it's a piece of crap? And don't quote me on that, but it happens. You know, in Activision, that didn't happen.
Also, of course, coin-op is out there, and so you know that's what games should look like. We allegedly should have no chance to look anything like a coin-op game. You know, they have their own hardware for every game. Every time they start a new game, they get to say, "Oh, here's the hardware we need to make it work." We don't have anything like that. We're stuck with that hardware. But we'd like something that looks something like this, since it's the same target market going out and shoving quarters into Asteroids or whatever that goes and buys a cartridge of ours. So
Donkey Kong.
Yeah, so the fact that we can make something that looks that looks a little bit better than you would expect, that little bit better can make a difference. And that kind of little attention to detail makes people think, yeah, this is, I can come home and play this game, and it's still fun. It's still interesting to look at. It's still great to play, just like where I'm shoving quarters into a machine like Pac-Man or something of that sort.
I got a question. Regarding the license that you were talking about, like the coin-ops and whatnot, once you guys finished games or while you were developing, did you have to submit them back to say, like, for instance, Dave, or maybe Gary, you can answer this, Dan, Ghostbusters, would have had to submit that back to Sony for their approval, or say with any of the other coin-ops as well?
Well, Activision, I mean, in the early days, we didn't do a lot of licensed properties or coin-ops. Ghostbusters was later, and Dave did the original Ghostbusters on C64, and then Dan, and actually Dave and I got involved in the 2600 one as well. We did the 2600 one. But yeah, obviously there was license approval. But I don't think it was sophisticated as it is today. The movie studios have now gotten to the point where they think they actually know something about interactive. Yeah, back then they didn't.
Well, was there a case like when they would look at Ghostbusters and say, that doesn't look like a ghost?
I don't know. I mean, Dave, you're closer to that because you were involved with the original design on Ghostbusters.
Well, Ghostbusters is pretty much a special case for a couple of reasons. When I think about how to answer that question, it's hard to separate the line between Atari and Activision, having worked at both, and it's like an evolutionary step. The early days of video games before Activision, as Matt was saying, the arcade was king. Atari owned a lot of arcade licenses, very big properties that they wanted to get into the home. So there was a lot of pressure to put the arcade game into the home game. But that was being done from within Atari rather than as it is right now where you have lots of different companies that have to do a lot of approvals. So that was a lot easier from that standpoint. So when we're talking about an arcade game, unlike a movie, it was often easier because nobody was licensing them from somebody else. the people who own the arcade games were doing the home games for that sort of thing.
There's another big difference between the current market and what Activision was doing in that era. Activision was an independent publisher. It was not licensed by any of the hardware manufacturers to create games for their systems. So we didn't have this intermediary level of approval required as you have today from the Sonys and Nintendos of the world.
So back to Ghostbusters. The primary reason that Ghostbusters was different is you think of Ghostbusters as possibly one of the hottest summer blockbuster movies ever to come along with all these Saturday Night Live stars, where in actuality, they had no idea what they had. I already turned that one on. You can have it on.
I think it's on.
I was just recently recalling an interview with Dan Aykroyd where he said, you know, are you kidding? If we knew how big that was going to be, we wouldn't have given Bill Murray all the funny lines. They had no clue that it was going to be big, and when it came to us as a possibility to do a licensed video game, I had, I think, 12 weeks to make a video game, and we did not do games in 12 weeks back then. And we would have turned down the project, but for the fact that I had a game that was halfway finished, that I looked at and I said, I can retask this game and turn it into what you know as C64 Ghostbusters. So that made it possible, and I wouldn't have taken it if I couldn't do a good game in the time allotted. But since the studio had no clue how big the thing was going to be, they weren't in the way at all. This was just a dinky little movie that they'd let these guys, these comedians, do. So as I said, it was an exception in many different ways. And it happened so fast, nobody even knew it was being done in the studios, most likely, before it was finally finished.
What was the working name in that game before it was Ghostbusters?
I was working on a game I was thinking in terms of, I was calling it Car Wars. And the whole car driving through the city after you go back and you equip it and you add different equipment to the car and all this kind of stuff. I was thinking in terms of that was going to be weaponry. And it was all going to be a car driving game. And by the time I got it back around to where I might do something like that, there had been three or four of them done. But so that was half of the game in Ghostbusters. You know, hook up your ghost vacuum and suck up those ghosts as you're driving around. Let's just turn them all off.
Well, they are trying to record it.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I'll yell.
More questions? Go ahead. The emulation that... Well, I mean, my first thought is it amazes me that people spend the time and effort that they do to write those things. And how do they pay their mortgage? I mean, I don't have time to sit down and write a piece of code that elegant and that incredibly complex for free. I don't know how people do it. It's very cool. Obviously, the distribution of the games gets into all sorts of copyright questions, which fortunately I think very few of us up here have to worry about because we don't own those games. So it's not our problem. It's actually that guy back there. It's more his problem. The guy who was asking the question. He works for the current Activision. I think it's really neat. It's great because it keeps the whole classic gaming genre alive, because you can still play them without having to go into your attic and find some dusty old piece of hardware.
I believe that some of you guys are doing with a company called Skyworks or
an
internet company.
Yeah, Dave, Al, and I are with Skyworks.
Now, do you enjoy that because it allows you to kind of go back to the roots where like maybe a single person can do all the R's and all the programming? Is that enjoyable?
Yeah, I mean, for people who don't know, Dave and I founded Skyworks in 1995 with the concept of, we were surfing the internet and fascinated by it and went to a couple of places where there were, quote, games, and they were pretty sad, honestly, at that point. So we said, boy, this is no different than anything else we've ever done. I bet we could do some pretty cool games in this platform. So we learned the internet technology and started developing games. And very quickly, it was clear that there were major sponsors and brands that were trying to market the kids online and needed an avenue to do it, and games was a great avenue. So we started selling our sponsorship in our games to Fortune 500 companies. 1997, we launched the Lifesavers Candy Stand. It's a gaming site on the internet. has about 50 free games sponsored by all brands of the Lifesavers company. Most people don't know that probably a third of the games on that site are done by David Crane. I mean, we don't give credit, but they're incredibly fun, incredibly addictive. The games are played, most popular games on that site are played 2 or 3 million times a month. So it's a tremendous mass audience way to play our games. And we've analyzed it, and probably subconsciously one of the reasons why we love to do this is because we went back to the roots of having to do something really small, because it's a download, it can't be huge, and it's very difficult to do something on the internet. You have to write very elegant code because you're running on a machine that's in a browser, that's in a plugin, and you got 4 layers of technology between you and the hardware, so you have to write the code really well to make the game perform. And it's a nice, simple 8 to 12 week project that, unlike the 2600 where we did the art, we actually have a design staff that does the art for us, but it is one programmer essentially controlling the game and the gameplay. And there's no hiding behind full motion video or 10 minute 3D FMVs. I mean, this is about fun games. If the games aren't fun, in a second and a half, they hit the back button on the browser and they're off doing something else. So to that extent, we love it because it's back to making great fun games. So go to skyworks.com and you'll find links to all of our games. Well, the problem is these are our clients are Kraft Foods and Pepsi and Nabisco and Lifesavers and MTV and Comedy Central, and nobody wants credit on their site. We will eventually launch our own gaming site as an outgrowth of Skyworks, and that design, which is already in development, has a credit area on every page, which says, here's the game, here's the designer, learn about the designer. So we are going back to our Activision roots. No, we actually don't. We have nothing hidden.
Are you sure about that, Gary?
not that I can disclose.
Activision's really one of the few classic game companies that's still around.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it's very different from when you guys started it. At what point did you feel that your initial concept of what Activision should be got away from you?
Well, I wasn't a founder, so it's really Al and Dave can address that.
I think it has to do with the perception of the future. Bob Whitehead and I left at the end of 1984. We'd been there for 5 years. We thought the future was in personal computer games, and we wanted to explore that more aggressively, and so that's why we left at the end of 1984. And I was at Accolade for 10 years after that.
What about you, Dave?
Well, I don't know if that's exactly the when did you stop beating your wife type question. You're asking me when did it become not my vision or whatever. You know, the business did change quite a bit. It wasn't just Activision, it was the entire business. And the interesting thing about that was when we started the company in 1979, we had a 5-year business plan. And that 5-year business plan said that the video game business and the cartridges, such as the Atari cartridges, were still going to be the primary business for about the next 4 to 5 years, at which time they would start to roll off. And home computers, which we could see on the horizon, at the time it was the Apple PET and Radio Shack, Apple II, the PET, you know, Commodore PET, and the Radio Shack TRS-80, but the PC was just a dream still. But those computers, we could see that was coming, there was a revolution coming. We expected that would start to ramp up over the next 5 years, so that by 1984-85, the decline of the video games would cross the rising of the home computers and we'd move on into home computers. And 5 years later, in the 1984 time range, the business was right about where we put it in our business plan. What we missed was this peak that went up, you know, about 30 stories high and then back down to where it was here. So looking at it one way, we could say, yeah, we started here. Here's this business. It's doing just like what we said it was going to do, except we missed this little peak and that was nice. Well, the problem is, when you're on any kind of a downward cycle, as everybody knows what happened to the video game business, a lot of things happen, and you know, the business changes, the companies change, the people change, and all. So really, you know, we rode a tremendous roller coaster up, and we rode the tremendous roller coaster down, and when it was all said and done, we were really about where we thought we would be, but philosophically and just, you know, the whole business had changed so much that it was not the same, not where we expected to be, let's put it that way.
Yeah, Ken.
Did your guys' leaving have anything to do with the ousting of Jim leaving and Bruce Davis just not being very cool? Yes.
Well,
I mean, around that time, or
Jim was CEO there for 3 years after Bob and I left. I can't answer for Dave.
So you're dodging the question.
How long were you at Activision?
I think about a year and a half. I was...
curiosity, why so short?
I got laid off.
Because of the crash?
What's that?
Is that because of the crash?
Okay, I'll say it's because of the crash.
I'm sure it was, Matt.
Yeah, me too.
Yep.
Plenty of other people got their a boot in their butt at the same time, so it wasn't anything necessarily personal. Of course, my favorite story is that the week after I get laid off, I win money on Jeopardy, and so I get a year off. That was nice. And also, I got a nice severance package, so it wasn't like I was out selling pencils on the street.
How many days were you a champion on Jeopardy?
Three-time champ. I lost the fourth day. Of course, you had to watch the fifth day to see if I had won. How would I have done the fifth day? Fifth day, I would have been the only one who got the final Jeopardy question right. I could have been a contender, not a bum. That's why I am. Let's face it.
So I guess I stayed at Activision longer than these other guys. So I remember when Jim Levy left and Bruce Davis came in as the new president. And one of the things Bruce did was he wanted to recognize the transition and between the cartridge market and the emerging home computer market. So he thought the company needed a name that reflected the fact that the company was transitioning to this new business, and the name Activision at that time had grown kind of stale. So they thought and they mulled it over, and after weeks and months of consulting with people, they came out with the name Mediagenic.
Ouch.
And my friends and I looked at each other and said, you know that story about if you're out in the middle of the desert, in this case I guess out in the middle of Las Vegas, and you see somebody walking down the street all dressed in black, and it's 115 degrees. And you realize that's pretty much all you need to know about the guy to realize he's not quite straight, and doesn't have it all together. So we said, you know, after months of preparation, they came up with the name Mediagenic. And it was even hard to say. And so we figured that's really all we need to know about the direction the company is taking.
Yeah, it was actually, I mean, it was a very sad time. And when you look back on it, in hindsight, there were decisions made for all the wrong reasons. The game business had crashed royally, and I wasn't a founder, but I was obviously, I bought into the vision and was very aware of it. And the whole theory of the designers were king, let them figure out what the products are, that all went out the window when it crashed. Like, everyone rethought the philosophy of the company when it wasn't the company's fault that the video game industry had crashed. It was all the other companies' fault that the video game industry had crashed. We were still doing great products. The problem was everybody who had access to venture capital and a moron who knew 6502 put out video game cartridges, and there were 30 companies putting out extremely bad video game cartridges among Dave's newest title. So you could walk in and buy 6 video game cartridges for the price of Dave's newest title, and parents didn't know, and they bought the 6 $2 cartridges instead of Dave's title. So it wasn't Activision's fault, but Activision's reaction was, well, we've got to rethink, we've got to diversify, let's not do games anymore, let's do all creativity stuff, and let's do this and that, and let's get marketing more involved, because obviously we were doing something wrong, which was the biggest mistake. I mean, I tell a story about when I joined Activision, the first time I went, I was on the East Coast, the first time I went to California, and I went into the company, the design group was behind the locked door. And I went over to that locked door and asked somebody to open it, and they looked at me like I was out of my mind. And nobody goes in there. That's where the designers are. And marketing didn't get through that door until the game was done. And the game was handed out through a little slot and said, here, go sell it. Marketing didn't come in and say, hey, you know, there are 34 Dooms out there and they all sell, so we want a 35th one. You know, that's not the way the company was run. And unfortunately, I think that's the way the company became. And I'm more likely to say this stuff because I wasn't a founder, so I'm allowed to criticize a little bit.
Well, I was talking about the locked door. We had a woman who was our receptionist, an older woman. And the idea that we were rock stars, that didn't help her. I think they told her that we were like Sinatra. And she got that, okay, we're like Sinatra. And there was one day when I got a phone message. Said, a woman called, she says she's your mother. And I had to explain to her, we are not that important. It is not like everyone in the world absolutely wants our time and someone would fake being my mother. You know, it was, in fact, my mother.
In fact, it was your mother. It's amazing.
Yeah. So to elaborate a little bit on what Gary was talking about, remember we were walking around CES one year, and that's when just about everybody and his brother had gotten into the video game business, and Quaker Oats had a video game booth, if you can believe it. And we looked at all this junk, and we thought it was just schlock, and we looked and we laughed and said, this is funny, all these companies are producing crap, they're all going to be out of business next year.
Yeah, little did we know.
And, which they did, but then they dumped their inventory on the market, which caused the price of all the games to drop.
No, I was never an employee. What I did was I back-engineered the Atari 2600 on the East Coast for an independent engineering company I worked for. I mean, that's a funny story. I was doing electronic toys, inventing toys, and licensing them to Parker Brothers and Milton Bradley and such, working for this little small inventing company.
Wickstead Design.
And I went to Jim Wickstead, who was the owner of the company, and I was just this schlub in the back room. And I said, you know, Jim, if you look at the business, I said, these electronic toys, like Mattel Football and the Bank Shot game I had done for Parker Brothers and another game I engineered, I said, they're all getting their butts kicked by this Atari 2600. And there's this company in California, Activision, who just got started, and they're actually doing games that work in that machine, and they're not Atari. It's amazing. No one's ever done that before. So I have an idea. I'm going to go out, I'm going to buy a 2600, I'm going to rip it open, I'm going to figure out how it works, I'm going to back engineer it, and we should do 2600 cartridges. And he said, go back to your desk. So then I was, so 6 months later, he comes back and he goes, I have a brilliant idea. We're going to get into the video game business. And now it was his idea, it was a good idea. So I back engineered the 2600, I did a game called Space Jockey. And I said to him, who are we going to take it to? Are we going to take it to Activision or are we going to take it to Atari? I mean, which one? The next thing I know, Quaker Oats Man's carrying it around. I don't know anything. I don't know how it happened. I didn't make the deal. I quit as soon as that happened. Went on my own. But I never had anything to do with the Quaker Oats deal.
Did Dan work for Wickstead Design as well?
Dan worked for Wickstead as well.
And Steve?
Yes. Yes. Everybody. And other guys. Roger Booth. I don't know if you know Roger Booth. Roger Booth.
What did he do?
He did a bunch of the what became the U.S. Games. He was one of the original people who worked on Little Computer People until Activision acquired it and Dave took it over. He now works for us at Skyworks.
Isn't John Van Rysen
with us at Skyworks as well? He came 1 year.
He was here last year.
He was here 2 years ago. No, he's off doing something on the internet, ungamely, something that's not related to games.
Just wanted to know, like, what Steve's up to, like, Larry and Bob.
Well, I worked at Electronic Arts for about 7 or 8 years doing the Tiger Woods golf games, which got me a chance to become really good at golf. and then
you too, if you play Tiger Woods golf.
So EA went through a transition about 2 years ago. What they decided was that we're going to model our business more like the movie industry. So they hired some executives from LA, and they laid off all the permanent employees, and they treat it more like a movie. Once a project gets green-lighted, they hire 100 people on a short contract, produce a game, then they all get laid off. So that's kind of the end of the way EA has been. Up until recently. So I got together with somebody I've known since the Activision days named Scott Orr, who is responsible for Madden Football. And we're doing some games that we hope will constitute, doing some cell phone games. Now, there isn't a market yet, but maybe someday. And the interesting thing about it is that I came in, I hadn't programmed in a dozen years. I didn't know anything about this new technology. I said, well, don't worry, we have some real experts that'll help you out. And within 2 months, I'd blown by them all. He said, oh, how do you do this? The phone only has 64K of memory.
Only.
I said, what do you mean, only? Let me tell you back in the day.
Right.
So by using the same techniques we used 20 years ago, I'm doing some pretty neat stuff.
Let's see, Bob Whitehead and I started Accolade in 1984. And Bob was with us for several years. He retired in the early 90s. He's very involved with his church work. He's been on missionary trips to Russia a couple times. And he's essentially retired for about the last 10 years. Larry Kaplan, I've sort of lost track of Larry. Last I heard, he was working at E-Trade, high-level systems kind of work. You hear anything more about Larry?
Nothing beyond that.
Carol Shaw
got into the industry from Tandem Computer, very serious dual processor computer company. She did work for us at Atari, and then she joined us at Activision, did River Raid, wonderful game, and a couple other games. She went back to Tandem, and sort of lost track of Carol too, but she went back into the serious computer stuff. She was a very brilliant computer scientist.
She has actually long since retired.
She's married to Ralph Merkel. Ralph is one of the pioneers in RSA-like computer security systems, and he's the mover and shaker in the nanotechnology these days. So they're a brilliant pair of people.
Yep, back there. This is the question that Dave Crane hates to answer. Dave, why don't you go first?
Well, it's usually asked in a slightly different way. What's your favorite game? You know? And I have to say that my favorite game is the one I'm working on, because if it wasn't, what am I doing there? You know, you really have to devote the energy, all of the energy that you would otherwise use playing games, to one project, that game you're working on right now. Because to do a game and do it well, you know, you'll spend 16 hours a day. When the deadlines come, you will, you know, miss sleep. And I also like to think of it as you're building an entire world. A lot of science fiction authors have this same kind of discussion. They'll get together and they'll have a world-building conference. And literally, they just sit down and they say, okay, this planet's going to be, oh, let's give it 2 times Earth's gravity. And then, because it has 2 times Earth's gravity, of course, you know, you've got this Coriolis effect over here, the current of the tides, and they actually, they apply real science to science fiction to the point where they've created a world that could exist. And they've built a world, and now, you know, one of them might use that and go write a novel about it. We do very much the same thing in many of our games. We're creating a world. If we want there to be gravity in this world, we have to give them gravity in this world. If we want things to bounce, we have to set up the elasticity of what the object is and what the object is that you're bouncing against. So you've got 1,000 different, highly detailed technical ideas in your mind at the same time. And if you don't, you're going to write code for 3 or 4 weeks, and what you get doesn't work with what you wrote 3 or 4 weeks ago. So you've really got to pay attention to it. So again, it's a roundabout answer to why I don't really have a favorite game. I put all of that effort into the current game that I'm working on, because if I didn't, it wouldn't come out.
Well, and let's go real roundabout, and we'll tell a funny story, which I'll tell, Dave, unless you want to tell the Canyon Bomber story, which relates to what Dave just said. And I heard this from Dave, and he can interrupt me if he likes, if I'm inaccurate. But when he worked at Atari, he did a game called Canyon Bomber. Does everybody remember Canyon Bomber? Well, the planes flew over, and you dropped the bomb, and it knocked the bricks out, essentially. And he was working on this game for quite a while, and when it knocked the bricks out, the bricks would fall. It would cut a hole in the bricks, and the bricks would fall down with gravity and resettle, and then you dropped again, and it would be a constant. As the cavity was made, the bricks would fall more. And then with the Atari, they had all the switches that gave you 650 variations on every game. So they put in a variation, Dave did, where you flipped one of the switches, and now the bricks didn't fall. So it was a different dynamic. And he actually had that version running, and his secretary's eyes just dropped when she saw it and said, "How did you make them stay up?" suspending belief completely. It's a real world. How did you do that? It was anti-gravity. But I tend to say games that I like that other designers did, because I find it hard to look at my games and say which game was my favorite game that I did, because you get so close to them that, I mean, I like them all for various reasons, but I'm too close to them to give any sort of a opinion. But I was totally addicted to Steve Cartwright's Mega Mania game. I put hundreds of hours of play into that when I probably should have been writing a cartridge. But it was incredibly addictive. And my brother Dan and I were world champs at Al's hockey game, to the point where Al doesn't remember this, but we were youngsters, and we had visions of working for Activision, and we flew to California for a job interview. And, you know, these guys were legends, and we're ushered into a conference room, and in comes walking Dave Crane and Al Miller. And Dan, who's a little better game player than me, just a little, but he was definitely better. The way these guys are going to interview us is they pull a 2600 out, pop in a cartridge, and go, "Hey, you want to play?" So Al sits down to play hockey against Dan, and Dan beats him. And I knew right there we had the job. I said, well, that's it. I mean, Dan had some shot that Dan did it once or twice, and Al just kind of looked and said, what are you doing? Yeah, some little twitch. It was amazing.
Well, that brings up some other stories. I mean, we will intersperse these stories that some of you will have already heard, but I have to talk about Gary and how he joined Activision. Gather a group of basically four guys at that point, right?
Right.
And you had done the reverse engineering, and you guys were becoming competent at doing this kind of stuff, working on Apple IIs for your development environment and all this.
Yeah, we had Apple IIs wired into Atari 2600s.
Yeah. Yeah. And why don't you just tell us how you ended up at Activision rather than Atari?
Yeah, that was funny. I was finishing up Space Jockey, or I had just finished it, and then I was working on Donkey Kong for Coleco, just as an independent developer. And I just picked up the phone one day, and I called Activision, and I asked for somebody in product development. So I got this guy, Tom Lopez, on the phone, and I said, I'm in New Jersey, I'm writing 2600 games, and want to know if you guys are interested in opening an office out here. And his answer was, yeah, right. Because there was nobody doing 2600 games on the East Coast. I mean, basically, the only people doing 2600 games were Atari or Activision, and it was really no one else. But I ended up convincing him I was doing Donkey Kong for Coleco, and he should talk to us. At the same time, we contacted Atari and told them the same story, and Atari said, well, you should come out, and they flew us out and treated us like kings and brought us in for a big interview and said, here's all these projects we want you to do. At the same time, we came out and visited Activision. It was much more low-key, but Activision was, you know, designer's king, creative freedom, best quality out there. And it came down to a choice between the two companies. And just when we were about to make the choice, a very big... I have to be careful here. I don't want to offend anybody. a very large, visible arcade adaptation came out on the 2600. Which just, you know, if you had epilepsy, you'd go right into an attack, I'm telling you. We're talking some serious flicker here. And I called Atari, I said, I can't, we're going to do Activision. We like the quality of their games better. And they were furious. And I'm just, I snot-nosed kid, I didn't know anything. So they said, well, we want to have a meeting in New York City. So we had gone to California. So one of the co-founders takes me to the top floor of the Warner Communications building and takes me in the Manny Gerard's office, who runs the division that owns Atari. And I'm just a kid. I have no idea this guy's important. I don't know who he is. They just wanted to have a meeting. So they waltz me in there and sit me down, and he's confident as all hell he's going to convince me that Atari's the way to go. And his office is the size of, you know, it's like 4,000 square feet. So we sit down, and he says, all right, what do we have to do to make this deal happen? And I said, I said, I can't work for a company that puts out a piece of crap like that game. And he just, his jaw hit the table, he threw me out of the office, and I worked for Activision. And that was it. It's amazing. Very funny.
Now, the story goes on. He had to break this to his brother and his partners. I mean, this guy's working with him.
I think there was at least one guy in the group who said, what are you, crazy?
It was John Van Ryza.
Yeah.
And he basically says, no, wait a minute, you know. He's got he's New Jersey. And he says, you know, if we work for Atari, we can do any kind of piece of crap and get paid for it. If we work for Activision, we're going to have to make good stuff. Are you out of your mind?
So we took the road less traveled, essentially, is what it was.
And then I discovered on a trip to their office in a little dusty box, you guys probably remember that some of the early Activision catalogs had pictures of the four designers when there were just the four of us before Steve. And I found that one of their guys had taken that catalog and put tracing paper over the pictures and drawn in each of the four of them.
Right, caricatures of us on pasted onto the Activision catalog with the four Activision designers. So Dave thought that was great.
So this is what they wanted. This is really what they wanted to be.
We wanted to join Activision. That's where the best games were done. I mean, you wouldn't want to work for, you know, anywhere else. Not that all the games, not that there weren't good games coming out of Atari. There were some good games, but there were some bad games too. So
you made the right choice, Gary.
I think we did.
And that is pretty much why Dave and I started Activision. We both worked at Atari before that. I joined Atari at the beginning of 77, even before they'd introduced the VCS, specifically to do games for the VCS. And right around that time frame, actually, Atari was purchased by Warner Communications at the end of 1976. So the transition occurred a couple months before I joined. And Nolan Bushnell, the founder of Atari, was still there in senior management capacity for several more months, but after a while the Warner guys chased him out pretty much and replaced him with another gentleman, who shall go nameless at this point, that it just didn't fit. Nolan had worked in arcades, he had introduced the home games, he knew about the development of arcade machines, he was an electrical engineer, so he knew both the creative side of the business side of the business, and the technology side of the business. And they chose to replace him with somebody from the textile industry who knew nothing about the business. And I can remember the first meeting that he had with the engineering group to try to convince us that he was going to be a good manager. There were about 70 or 80 of us in the room, and Dave was there. And somebody after Ray, let's call him Ray, gave his...
just to use a name, if you had to assign a name.
After Ray gave his little 5 or 10 minute speech, he opened it up to questions, and somebody piped up from the back, "Well, you've had all this experience importing and exporting fabric. What do you know about dealing with creative people?" And he said, "I've worked with creative people all my life, towel designers, for example." And we were just stunned that he would respond in such a cavalier attitude to a very, very serious and important question to us. And like Steve was saying about somebody wearing a black outfit in the middle of the noonday sun here in Las Vegas, you just knew something was wrong there.
Yep.
That was sort of the beginning of the end for us there. I loved working at Atari. Had a lot of fun there, worked with great people, did great stuff, but they changed dramatically after Warner took over.
Yep.
How did you guys come up with the name Activision?
Well, it was better than the first name they came up with. It's VSync.
VSync Inc.
VSync.
I don't think VSync would have worked as well on the TV spots with the rainbow, you know?
How about Vita Games? That was another early
Vita
name.
Vita Games, yes.
Vita Games. One of my favorites was Trial and Error Engineering. Actually, Jim Levy, who was the CEO at Activision, Dave and I and Larry and Bob wanted to break off and start a new company, so we approached a law firm in Silicon Valley that was very famous for starting companies and engaged them. And the first thing they told us, "You guys are just engineers. You know, you need a serious businessman to be the CEO of this corporation." They put us in touch with Jim Levy, brilliant marketing person, good management guy. And so we started work on putting Activision together. Jim came up with the name of Activision. I believe he said he was just driving along the road one day, and he saw something that said television, and he put the word active in front of it and just came into his own mind. I think it's a brilliant name.
Yeah, it's a brilliant name.
But of course, we were engineers, so...
Yes, Ken. Kevin Calcutt didn't release a game.
Austin.
Alex. Alex DeMeo joined
later.
A little later.
Right.
And John Van Ryzen.
Right. This was the East Coast Design Center.
Boston Design Center, just a building?
Now, well, what the Boston Design Center was there were guys who were working for Parker Brothers at the time who wanted to leave. Right, and they spun off. And since we had a what they called a creative development manager. A guy, an administrative guy in our office, they said, "Well, we could open an office in Boston, and he's only a shuttle flight away, and he could manage that office too."
Is that Tom Lopez?
No, that was Jim Charney. Yeah, and so that's what they did. They opened the office up there, and he kind of bobbled back and forth between the two offices.
Am I talking with a member of a particular character, that guy at all? They said he basically come in and he once a week, and that was about it.
Yeah, but we actually have a soft spot in our heart for Jim. Jim was one of the guys who knew what he didn't know. I mean, he wasn't a guy, you put a guy in that position, clone creative development manager, the next thing you know, he's coming back telling us he has some great ideas for games. And Jim would never do that. Jim's job was to make sure the rent was paid and to make sure that whatever had to come from the West Coast came to the East Coast and things like that. And Jim actually went on to be very successful. He was the president of the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences until a year ago when he and he's a lawyer in the industry. He's a very good intellectual property lawyer. I don't know what they particularly didn't like about him. To me, he did everything I wanted him to do, which was stay out of creative, and that was great.
Well, Gary, let's not go into specifics on the Boston Design Center. Ken is asking kind of insider questions. We can have a sidebar if you want.
Yeah, I agree.
Specifics about Boston Design Center, but the Design Center concept is something that might interest the people here.
Yep.
When we started Activision, there were four of us, and we knew we worked together well because we had worked together well at Atari. We went to lunch together. We basically. during the work hours anyway, we did everything at the same time. We helped each other. We played test each other games. We knew what this person was more capable of this and this person was more capable of that. We, you know, benefited from our strengths and supported each other's weaknesses. It was a great group. You can't grow a company on that. I mean, there are four people, and Levy asks us, he said, okay, you know, we want to grow. I said, no, we like this. We kind of like those four guys working together, having a good old time. He said, no, that's not going to work. And actually, so the first thing we did is, all right, more important than what a person is capable of doing is, can they get along with the four of us?
Gee, thanks.
Yeah. And that's where Steve came in.
Steve is a friend of mine from college, and in fact, the little known fact is he and I played professional foosball together. But he had never written a line of code in his life. Now, he had taught microprocessor programming.
You never told me that, Dave.
He had never written a line of code in his life, never designed a game, and actually he thought this looked like something fun, so he came to us and showed us three or four game design ideas. They were reasonably simple modifications of what we'd done. Like that cool skiing game you did, turn it on the side and make a river rafting, or so, you know, things like that. But when we, you know, talked to him, we could see that he had the ideas and the concepts, knew kind of, thought the same way that we did, so we took a chance on him. But we couldn't do that. You couldn't have 15 or 20 or 30 guys working in the same room and all having that same synergy, helping each other, working, you know, just trip on everybody's feet. So while we were trying to figure out exactly how to do that, we were talking about a design philosophy which has been published by, you know, savants all over the world now as this great idea of, we said, all right, there's five of us, why don't we each go out and find three or four other guys who we could work with? And I say guys loosely, I mean, we had one or two female game designers back then, but they there weren't a lot of them around, right? But why don't we do that? We'll take one person, and then you surround yourself with people you can work with, and maybe we can grow like that. And we were working on this philosophy when a group materialized on our doorstep, which was Gary and his buddies. And he said, this is great. Not only does it, will give it a chance, give us a chance to test our theory of how to keep a small core of guys together with good synergy, they're also 3,000 miles away and they won't bother us. So we gave them a try. And it worked so well, and the business was so booming, and we were so trying to grow, that they just started spotting and sprinkling up all over the place.
Yeah, I guess that's where the Boston,
we had Sacramento, we had, I don't know.
To pop up these little design offices where there was a group that already had synergy working together.
Didn't work all that well that way.
No. I mean, there was only so much good talent.
Yeah.
You know, you keep trying, eventually some of them aren't going to stick, and some of them didn't, so. What game did it look like?
Actually, there was an arcade game called Drag Race.
Okay.
And yes, we did a home game called Dragster. And yes, it did look an awful lot like Drag Race. And the only concession to that was the fact that we changed the name. And I did the game Dragster. And I may have been inspired. I may have been inspired by the arcade game.
Right. Huh? Yes, I agree. You probably were inspired. Yep.
Speaking of inspiration and imagination, in a field that you work in, that's very important, your job, how did you maintain that constant imagination and inspiration to produce games?
Well, I'll answer that first. In 25 years in inventing and creating toys and games, ideas have never been a problem. I mean, you usually have 10 dozen stacked up that you'd want to work on if you had time. It's making them that's all the takes all the effort. So you know, inspiration just comes easy to some people. I mean, we would, when you'd finish a game, you'd look and say, well, I'd love to do this or I'd love to do that, and I had this idea for this thing, and you'd make a decision which direction you wanted to go. The idea is, I mean, that's why we always laugh. You know, somebody find out what we do for a living and some will come and go, I have an idea for a game. And you feel like saying, well, look, there are a million ideas. It's making the game that's the hard part. We don't need the ideas. The ideas we've got. So I never had an issue with the inspiration or the ideas. It's buckling down and spending the 2 months to a year to making them that really brings them home.
At the back of the room.
What is Activision's biggest selling title to date?
To date? Well, it's got to be Pitfall.
Well,
Dave's game, but I don't know about if that has that been eclipsed by the current Activision, Ken?
It's possible, yeah.
Which Mech Warrior or something.
Tony Hawk.
Tony Hawk.
Across all the variations.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if you're talking classic Activision, prior to the new Activision, it would be Pitfall. Yep.
One thing I've always wondered about classic video games, and I've never really heard anything about it, I've always wondered who was behind all the people that were behind the artwork that appeared in the boxes. For example, the early Atari boxes had wonderful, beautiful artwork on them. And Activision always had this wonderful unity with all of this artwork in the early games, especially with the action lines, which I thought suggested active, you know, like the active in Activision, you know, the rainbow action lines. And I was wondering if there were just one person behind that or a team of people, even if that was even your department, you'd even know about that. I've always wondered, you know, who does the artwork.
Well, those are those marketing people I was making fun of before. And they were actually very skilled at Activision. I mean, Activision had a wonderful logo, and I agree with you, the continuity and the packaging was great. I was on the East Coast. I don't know. Who would that have been, Al?
Well, it was J. Walter Thompson, the biggest advertising agency in the world at that time.
I think it was Jim Levy's vision also.
Yeah, Jim was a brilliant marketing guy.
He called me aside once. We were walking through a store, and there were a bunch of Atari games stacked up there. And the game Superman was up there, and they had decided to use the Superman logo, which, yeah, I suppose that makes sense. And he just said, that's a mistake. He said, you need to have the continuity of a brand. You know, so he basically kept an idea or kept an eye on everything that was being done, made sure that, you know, there was continuity in the packaging, that you could line them all up and the games lined up. Basically, he was the art director.
Yep.
Of that.
Yeah. Jim Levy was brilliant. Yeah.
I always assumed that you had an artist in the house and did that, but I didn't realize you outsourced for that.
No, we outsourced for that. Because of Jim's brilliance in marketing, it made the job of being vice president of marketing a very tenuous job, and that was basically a revolving door at Activision because Jim was so pronounced in his opinions about marketing.
Yep.
Did any of you envision when you first started making games that they would evolve into what we see today as far as technology and gameplay?
Yeah. I think we did because we were intimately involved in the development of the personal computers. I know I and Larry Kaplan were members of the Homebrew Computer Club, which existed on the Stanford campus for a couple years, perhaps even before I became involved with Atari. So we were very aware of what was happening with PCs. Dave and I and Larry co-authored the operating system for the 400-800 and did some of the very earliest games for the 400-800. So we saw what computers were capable of doing. And yeah, we expected continued evolution towards photorealistic quality visual displays and very deep experiences, what you see today.
Yep.
I had a very favorite saying back then that ended up getting printed as Crane's Law, which is that man always uses his highest technology to amuse himself. And you see it every day. You see more power being used in the video game systems than you see on your desktop or, you know, in many different places. That's where all the computing power is. That's where all the expense is placed. I mean, I realized it one day when I thought that a wonderful thing would be an electric airplane because, you know, I guess I didn't like noise, but there was no such thing as an electric motor that had enough power to carry its own power source, itself and its power source aloft until a Japanese toy company came out with an electric toy. And it just struck me. I said, well, that's, of course, where it would have to happen. It comes out as a toy before it would become something that's usable. Now, is it NASA who's doing it? There's somebody putting up solar-powered airplanes that are going to fly and take the place of geosynchronous satellites in the near future.
Right. Yep.
I could be wrong, but I think I maybe remember you guys had some quarries at the stand-up arcade as well.
It was licensed.
Okay, I was wondering
if that was licensed. Yeah, wasn't us. It was licensed.
Okay. Did you ever think of getting into that?
No, we were having too much fun in the home market.
Yeah, it's a tough, tough business. So we worked side by side with the Atari coin-op people when we were at Atari, and boy, I think they threw away about 90% of the games that they developed. When they put them into market tests, they just didn't turn enough quarters, and And it's a really tough distribution business, so I think Dave and I were very aware of the difficulties of that business. And I think we also had broader market aspirations. That's one of the things that I enjoyed about the early days in the game business, is we created products striving to hit a very broad audience. And, you know, over my years in the game business, I became generally disillusioned with it as the market, the audience, the target audience for games seemed to get narrower and narrower and narrower. And I joined Skyworks about a year ago, and that's one of the things that I'm very happy about being associated with Skyworks. We create games for a wide audience, for children and adults, men and women. And it's just wonderful to create broad appeal games. Yep. Yeah.
Closed architecture.
Yeah, I don't know what you mean by open architecture, although...
Yeah, one thing that certain designers dislike about the evolution of the game industry is they've completely shut out, you know, any access to the hardware and have closed it all up and written layers and layers of OS and said, use these routines, they're great, and it's not as much fun as it was when you could just get right down to the chip level.
Oh, no question. Actually, an interesting development in the early days, well, middle days, we'll say, of the 2600, was some young kid in Chicago reverse engineered this system personally. Just what he wanted to do, so he opened it up and reverse engineered something that I had done, Gary had done also, but we were doing as part of a development company. He just did it on his own and developed the product. What was it called?
Magic Card.
The Magic Card. He's not in the audience, is he?
Dennis Chuinsky, where are you?
Anyway, he made one big mistake, is he sold the Magic Card, which was a fully functional development system for the 2600 with manuals for $150 a piece?
Something like that.
He could have sold the first 10 for $50,000 each, because every company had to buy it to find out what he knew.
And there was actually another engineer at the same time who was business savvy, who was selling manuals, back engineering Atari 2600 manuals for $25,000 a piece to every one of these companies that went to CES who entered the market. So here's the guy selling them for $25,000 a piece, and if you went in the back of Popular Electronics, you could send away for $150 and get the same thing from the kid in Chicago.
I bought one.
Yeah. Which one did you buy? The big one or the little one?
The little one.
But in any case, about that time, the 2600 still seemed to have legs, and there was no way for us to tell when was it going to end. You know, we're talking 650 different games that had been on the market for this machine. Its installed base was 26.5 million units, which we thought it was amazing when Atari sold their 6 millionth unit, and they ended up selling over 26 million of them. And yet, you like to believe that we're running out of ways to be creative with this thing after 600 games. So we decided if the 2600 had any legs, one way to extend that a little farther was to put intelligence in the cartridge, an extra integrated circuit in the cartridge that gave it a little more capability. Again, since the cartridge was the part that you replaced each time, you could give it more capability by putting something in the cartridge. And so we developed a chip which went into Pitfall 2.
Dave Crane developed that chip. We did not develop that chip.
It's the collective we, you know.
It's the imperial we.
Right.
Well, it was named with my initials, but it's called the display processor chip.
The DPC chip, the David Patrick Crane chip.
I take credit for the name.
Yeah. In any case, people ask, you know, of all the things you did in the past, what did you like the best? Well, that was cool. That chip was fun.
And think of all the years of headache it's called for the guys who write the emulators. How much trouble that chip has caused them.
Yeah, that emulating that, I was impressed when I saw an emulator for the Pitfall 2. But
what games was it in, Dave?
Just Pitfall 2.
Well, Dave, that actually goes to another rule of the video game industry, which as soon as you get to the point where the designers have mastered a system, that's when it stops selling at retail. And now you have to start all over with a new system.
Yeah, I suppose.
Happens every time. Yeah. You get to the point where you're just we're as good at the Nintendo 8-bit as we're ever going to be. Now we're going to write the best stuff that's ever been done, and the business crashes, and now you got to go start all over. It's happened about six times.
Yeah, that's because there tends to be about a five-year life cycle for these base units, the consoles, and it takes several years for the software people to learn all the tricks of the trade on a given system, and then because the inherent economics of silicon-based technology, where you have a factor of two performance increase every 18 months or so, all of a sudden, you know, three of those cycles down the road, you can create an eight times better machine after 5 years, and that's compelling for the hardware manufacturers to build the next generation of machine. One of the frustrations we had at Activision, you know, Dave and I and all the guys were over there waiting for the next generation of the Atari game system to come out. We thought the 2600 was brilliant. They kept saying they were spending $100 million a year in R&D, and we were, you know, anxiously awaiting what wonderful new machine is going to come out to sequel the 2600. And it never came. Never came. So
came pretty late.
I think that was... The 7800 was a wonderful machine. The 5200, I don't think we had too much respect for. It was just a repackage.
The 7800 was good, but it was way past
late,
the prime.
Way too late. And that caused part of the terrible demise in the mid-80s of the video game business, because there was not this orderly introduction of the next generation machine. The 5200 was not adequate technology to create a new market for video games. But 7800 was capable of doing that, but it was just, you know, it was 3 years too late, I think.
Until the Christmas of 1985, when this Japanese playing card company tried to sell a game system to Toys R Us at Christmas, and Toys R Us said, you have to guarantee every unit. If I don't sell them, you take them all back. And Nintendo said, okay. And
well, it's sadder.
Suddenly there was a business again.
It's sadder than that, because Nintendo approached Atari and offered Atari almost begged Atari to take over distribution of the Atari, the Nintendo 8-bit system throughout North America. And Atari, in their infinite wisdom, said, no, screw you. And that was the end of the story for Atari.
Right.
All of these facts about how technology keeps on going forward. One thing that I've noticed is, and why there's all you people in the audience, when a system dies, quite often, how are you ever going to play the best games you had on that system again? They're not going to get ported to the next system. You know, if you really want to play Pitfall, you've got to have a 2600. If you really want to play Mule, you got to have Atari 400. And they have done a very bad job of updating these things, and they are still fun, and that's why you people are sitting here, I think, and it's not surprising that something like this happens 20 years later. Though if you had asked me to predict it 20 years ago, I would have had no. I would say no one is going to ask for my autograph in 2002.
Well, that is a wonderful, the emulator opportunity is just wonderful, because all of a sudden people can go play these games. I'm very sensitive to the intellectual property ownership rights myself, having been a publisher for many, many years, but a lot of those games are abandoned now. Activision still remains in the business. I don't think you can trace Atari's rights very clearly anymore. They've been purchased and repurchased. So it is a wonderful opportunity to allow people to play some of these old games now on their PCs, and we're looking forward to some exciting announcement from Activision later this year along that line.
Let me ask one question of all of you guys. How many people in this room want to be game designers?
You've cowed them. All of them do. They're just afraid to say it to you.
My advice is stay out of the business.
Tough business.
Well, where the video game business is gone, certainly the console business, is $20 million for a product that might last 3 months in the market. It keeps getting bigger and more expensive and shorter lived. It astounds me, when I was in the console business, that I could work for years and put out the best game that I thought I'd ever put out, and it doesn't sell 3 months later because, oh, that's old. I've seen that. That came out last Christmas. You don't see that in the videos and television, movies. You still buy Back to the Future. I mean, you know, it's a great movie. You still watch these things.
No, Dave, my favorite example of that is I look with envy on Forrest Mars, that he created the Milky Way in 1890.
That's right.
And it's still selling. And we work for 5 years on something, and it sells for 2 months, and it's gone. It's just, it's unbelievable.
It doesn't have time to become a classic game anymore.
Right.
It's just gone. Nobody will buy it. Nobody will carry it. No one will sell it. That's right.
Try and buy these classic games. Even a couple years after the mid-80s, I'd be calling Carl or someone and say, look, I need this, I'm looking to buy me on a disc, I'll pay full price, I'll give you a package, you send me a disc.
Right.
No, we can't do that.
Yeah. So basically, my wife is in the plant business. She sells, grows and sells plants, and if she doesn't sell it, it gets bigger and she sells it for more. It's great. The video game, if you don't sell it, you take it back and you bury it in a landfill.
In New Jersey, which I know is like...
Yep. New Mexico, actually.
Well, is that the
I think it was New Mexico.
Have we used up all of New Jersey now?
Yes.
And we now have
New
to
Jersey's one large landfill. There's nothing left.
It's probably a vicious rumor, but there are rumors about one Atari title that will go nameless that they took back, filled up 19 semi-truck trailers, and dumped them in a hole in Arizona.
And built condos on top of it, I think.
To hide them,
Yep.
Do you think it has to do with the fact that most of your products stopped selling after 3 months because most of the games that come out today that I play have an ending? And part of the joy of the early games, like Pitfall, the rumors still, I still hear people talking today about the fact that Pitfall has an ending. Or that most of the perfection of the early games was the score. The fact that there were no endings. But products today, they all have endings. So after you play,
I think there's a ton of reasons. I think the earlier games, and I don't think there's any reason that's the right one, but there are a lot of factors. The earlier games, since they didn't have the 650 mega graphics and everything else, had to rely on being fun. So they had to have a mechanic, a play mechanic. Like one of my favorites was Stampede. I mean, that play mechanic of herding and roping was so addictively fun that you could just play it for hours. And I'm hard-pressed to find a $20 million PC or console game that focuses so narrowly on a great play mechanic rather than this monstrous experience, which after if you experienced it, you don't have this addictive nature to go back and experience it again. I don't know. That's one thought.
The problem I have with that is, don't the movies end too? And don't you go back and watch those good movies? You know how it's going to come out, and yet you still watch movies. And with the exception of this group of classic gamers, the main market for video games is give me the next thing or give me nothing at all. So my advice is don't.
I don't think the analogy with movies is a good one, Dave, because, you know... unless you're under the age of 9, you can't watch a movie 8 days straight. Now, my niece can do that because she loves, you know, some of the Disney classics, but I got to have at least, 3 or 6 months in between viewing a movie again. And a game is an active experience. Watching a television is a passive experience. It seems just altogether different. I agree with what you said. The games we made were designed to be played over and over and over and over again. Modern day games, to a large extent, are not designed that way. They're designed to be played through once, at which point you've solved the puzzle. The mystery's over with, why do it again? Not all games, but a good chunk of them are.
Yep.
How do you feel then about the kind of lag in technology that's allowing some of the classic games to be redone, like on the Game Boy Advance or on cell phones or various other fields, right? You've got like the Mario game that was already out on the NES. Released on the Game Boy Advance, sells another million copies, right? You can imagine maybe 5 or 6 years from now there'll be a handheld PlayStation or something like that, and then you'll be able to play Gran Turismo again on your cell phone or something else, and they'll just keep re-cranking these same games. Like even on the floor today, I can see a lot of classic games that are emerging on cell phones or on PC.
Yeah, I think that's really cool, and I think that in hindsight, the lesson's going to be learned that the intellectual property rights should be watched much more closely than they were. You know, as Al said, there are 2,600 rights for games that are all but abandoned or lost in bankruptcies or whatever. And I think that any intellectual property right for any game should be maintained because you never know where it's gonna, what watch it's gonna show up on or whatever down the road somewhere. I guess we're wrapping up. We're probably over our time. Anybody know?
Yeah, we're over.
Any other final thoughts? Yep.
Yeah, before Activision, if you looked at the TV screen, you instantly know or any other game system. Activision kind of not just went out...
A large part of that quantum leap that you saw was due to the fact that Larry and Dave and I spent about our last year working on the personal computer. And so there was a year where we didn't do game carts for the 2600. When we started Activision, we just jumped right back into the 2600, and we were probably a little bit more experienced by that time. What do you think, Dave?
A little more experience. I think we put a little extra time, maybe... You know, at Activision, maybe than we did at Atari even.
That was Pride. It was your company.
In peer review for the gameplay. So you did not get to look at it until we were happy with it. All right? If we didn't like the game, and we shelved completely final games. You can't do that today. I mean, if you've spent all that money on these games, they have to go out and hope you'll sell a few. But we would shelve a game if we, if first of all, we couldn't didn't like it and then couldn't fix it. Secondly, probably just a coincidental occurrence, we started paying a little more attention, I think, to the aesthetic look of the games